I don't know.
It could be that many.
Some of the cannibals carried two.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say the fighters probably carried that much.
But what about swinging the compass? Would you have to swing your compass, and would that be affected by your machine gun?
Yeah, of course there was not very much compass flying.
No.
While I was being transferred back and forth there, waiting for a squadron to form, you see, they were forming this independent air force, and there was some delay in I was booked first for 105 squadron,
mm-hmm.
and I was there, and then apparently, I don't know why it was changed, I haven't any idea, but then I went back to number 6 TDS again, and then eventually I went to the pilot's pool in France, right. And from there to 104.
Before we get there, I think this is quite important. When you were trained, were you trained as a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot?
Oh, no,
or strictly as a pilot?
Oh, no. You were trained, well, how can I put it? You weren't trained for fighting anyway. That's a cinch. Because you weren't flying that type of aircraft. I was flying two-seaters all the time.
Feel because you were into that at that time, because it was you were flying computers, it was automatically bombed?
I think you were allocated in London. I'm not sure. You see, there was quite an interview with regard to personal characteristics. One thing, of course, they asked, do you ride horses? Because that was supposed to give you very sensitive hands. And games, aggressive games, and that sort of
thing.
Team
sports versus team individual.
Sports, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was into sports. I played hockey and football and baseball, mm-hmm. but I suspect that I was earmarked. And then, as I mentioned on the other time, I think it was partly because of my height. Because I didn't fit into a small aircraft.
Tight fit. As bomber trained, I know you didn't have the fighter training to compare it to, but from later, what were the major differences? Would it be the formation, flying?
No, there was, at TDS, let me see now, there was very little training for actual fighting. Operational. There was very little operational training.
Having hours under your belt? Or?
No.
I was lucky
because the Germans started what they called the March push.
Yes.
And they nearly broke through, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
And there was a terrific...
Decimated the air force.
There was the Air Force was really decimated. There was a huge gap. People that got their wings after I did were sent over on artillery ops and so on, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, were fighting too, but not out of my squadron, not out of my training squadron. I don't know what it was. I think I was booked for this independent Air Force, and they stuck to it come hell or high water. Because I think they had trouble. I know that, what's his name? He was Governor General of Canada afterwards, Lord Binney.
Athlone?
What's his name?
Athlone?
No. He was Lord Binney afterwards. He was the one that organized the independent force. Trenchard, General Trenchard. He was the one that organized the Air Force, and he had the independent Air Force. And he had quite a job with the Air Ministry, getting it set up.
Yeah.
I know they didn't want to. See, what his idea was to put an independent group down near, it was south of Mons, Nancy. There was a big flat area there, and it was just filled up full of aerodromes. Eventually, it was to put day and night bombers down there to bomb the Rhine town. retaliation for bombing London. In other words, then that would divert some of the German Air Force for protection, home protection.
Home protection.
Yeah.
Now, you'd be quite rare in the sense that you'd have more flying time.
Yeah, that's right. I had considerably more flying time.
And that considerable would be, what, around 20, 30 hours, something like that?
It would be 50 or 60 hours. 60 hours, because when I was TDS, I'd get hold of a DH-6 at night, and at least at dusk, and go out and chase rabbits on the field. Around the field, out around there. And it was the funniest thing. You get over one of these rabbits, they come out at dusk, you see, out of the hedgerows and so on, and they'd be in the field there, and you spot them, you'd run ahead of them a little way, and then you'd be going faster than he would, and you just see them spread out as though he's trying to go in all four directions at once, just as you went over. And I put in quite a bit of time that way, too. And then I was flying different aircraft at different stations.
Getting well acquainted.
And then I was sent over to the it was a cloud. I called it a cloud flying course, but it was the first attempt at bombing. I don't know what that is. Navigation and bombing. I guess it was. Number one school, Stonehenge.
What about bombing here?
Well, I don't remember doing any practice bombing, but there may have been a little bit of it. I do remember the navigation part of it was quite important, and all you had was these little instruments, and your instructions was to go up in the clouds and get as far as you could, and then come down, you see.
The instruments being, so this the is a cloud-flying, pole-flying course. With head in bag navigation.
Well, there was some of that too. That was they still use that in blind in instrument flying. They still use that kind of training.
And your instruments were an airspeed indicator, a ball turn and bank indicator, and a compass.
Yeah.
And none of it could be relied upon. Is that correct?
Well. Yes and no. The airspeed was reasonably reliable. When I say reasonably, I mean you could depend on it.
What would you do with an airspeed? What would that tell you?
Well, it told you when you were stalling. It told you when you were climbing and when you were going down. If your airspeed slacked off, then you knew either the engine was failing or else you were playing too far, right?
Oh, my.
It's hard to realize.
Well, you flew modern aircraft after and during the Second War, and I guess for you, the shock must have been day and night.
Well, yes, I never did any instrument flying, though. That is any real instrument flying in later days, though.
Now, the bombing, you said you don't recall any actual bombing.
Bombing, but it's just in the back of my mind that there might have been a little bit of practice at this school in Stonehenge, just using dummy bombs.
There might have been. You wouldn't be going into... Now, what about tactics and formation flying and things?
No, there was no tactics, and I don't think there was any formation flying.
Gee.
I don't think so.
What about day or night squadron type things? Were you?
We were day bombers. The DH-9s were day bombers. They had special aircraft. That is, they had the FE-2. That was a pusher type of aircraft. A fighter experimental, that's what the FE stood for. BE was bombing experimental, you see. And they actually used to drop bombs by hand out of the BE-2. little 25-pound bombs. Anyway, to get back to the...
Types of aircraft.
And then they had the Handy Page, which came in Well, it wasn't the biggest one. It was a small one. It looked just exactly like a turkey landing. A great long fuselage and the neck stuck out, you know, and long undercarriage, and the thing looked exactly like a turkey landing.
Oh, dear.
But they were night flyers.
Now, you took your cloud flying course at Stonehenge.
Uh-huh.
And the idea being to rely on your instruments and have enough technical information.
Yeah.
And now flying in clouds prior to this time was considered very dangerous, is that correct? And it was to be avoided at most costs?
At all costs.
And what was the rationale behind that?
Well, that there were no training for it.
And
no instruments, you see. I mean, there was no instrument training whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And by instruments, I mean an airspeed.
Indicator.
and a turn and back.
Turn and back, an indicator and compass. None of this altimeter business.
Yeah.
Now, this continues on until June 1918. You arrive at the pilot's pool in France.
You got the date there.
I have my list here.
Yeah.
And then you were there for only 10 short days, and you were to report to 104 Squadron.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Now, when you got to 104 Squadron, you will be, what, greeted by the CO, is that correct? Or am I dreaming again here?
Well, I don't know what happened there. I know I reported to him. My logbook from all the traveling, you see, the logbook went with you. From all the traveling, I think one of the covers was off. It was, you might say, it might have been a little disruptible, you see, but it was my logbook. I mean, it was, it had done a lot of traveling, believe me, going to all these stations and so on and so forth. And I handed him the logbook, and he took one look at it, and he threw it on the floor. And then he yelled to me to pick it up. Now, whether it was to intimidate me, whether it was because I was the only Canadian on the squadron and he'd had some bad experience with Canadians, I don't know. But I was in bed with him right from the start.
Couldn't do anything right.
I couldn't do anything right, no. I just couldn't do anything right.
This would be the Irishman named Quigg, I guess.
Quigg, yeah. No. He was a nice, nice chap in a way, but he had a down on me for some reason. I just don't know what it was.
So you were the only Canadian in the squadron.
I was the only Canadian in the squadron, yeah.
To be 104 Squadron.
Yeah.
And his rank would be what?
Squadron leader.
Would be a squadron leader.
Yeah.
Okay, that is wing commander business then.
Squadron leader. Yeah.
Okay. And when you got there, did anyone take you under their wing at all, or what was the deal?
Well, after I picked up the logbook and little talk, I don't remember. I was half a mind to not pick up the damn logbook to tell the God truth. I was I was pretty independent, as a matter of fact. I'd have probably been court-martialed. But anyway, I didn't like it at all. I was pretty annoyed about the damn thing because I didn't. It wasn't my fault, really, you see. But I think Plodney, he'd been through a tough time, Quigg had. He'd lost a lot of people, the flight commanders and so on, because they were just promoting people who had lived through it there.
The survivors were being promoted.
The survivors were being promoted, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had a tough time at it, and there must have been something that I did, something about me that he didn't like. Well, anyway, then we did practice flying there. With the DH-9s, and I saw one DH-9 crash in the air, and he crashed into trees and just saw the branches waving. It's just like somebody waving what a goodbye, you see. And I had the misfortune too, and here's another thing I got in bad. I had the misfortune to break an undercarriage. It was grass fields, you see, and they had drainage ditches in there. And you always landed into wind, and somehow or other I ran across this drainage dish and of course the thing set down. And aircraft were scarce in those days. That was another thing that set me up. And I went back to the mess afterwards, and dinner. And he I could just get a vision of that. He signaled, he spotted me. He said, I thought I told you to help bring that aircraft in, right out in the mess. So there's nothing for me to do but to leave and help with the aircraft. Yeah. However.
What type of aircraft did the squadron fly?
DH-9s. They're all DH-9s.
All DH-9s. No mix of squadrons. So it's strictly a day bomber, DH-9.
That's right.
Now, I'm trying to think. As the new boy, I guess, would be what you'd be called then.
Yeah.
Would you go up with an experienced observer or another pilot to start?
No, I'm not sure when he came, but I had an American lieutenant for a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Observer, gunner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, we did some practice flying. I'd have to refer to this, and I don't want to take a lot of time looking at that. I don't know just when he came on, but I think it was on, I think he joined me, or we joined, from the first flight we made over the lines.
How long was it until your first flight?
It wasn't a very long one. It was a relatively short flight.
Would you call it a sortie then as well?
Well, it was a sortie, I suppose you'd call it. I don't know. I probably got it in the book there, but I wouldn't bother to refer to that. It wasn't a very long one. And I suppose it might have been, we might have been an hour over the lines, 90 miles or something like that. And I think we all got back that time. I'm pretty sure we all got back safely.
Would they give you any explanation, like on tactics, formation, flying, things like that?
No, you simply kept us close to the meeting. You knew where your position was. I assume there was a certain amount of briefing. There must have been before the flight, because you were allocated a certain position, and one man was allocated as a spare to go up and take the place of anybody. That's another story that'll come up later. Take the place of anybody who fell out. And
now your communication this time, what, the squadron leader have a banner off the strut or what?
Well, I don't remember. But you knew his aircraft. You kept his you watched
kept
his
your
aircraft.
Eyeball on him,
because that was the only, he was the doing the navigating. And you just followed him, you see.
Let's see. Now, you took Morse code. Morse code was part of the training for the RFC and things. Now, would you have wireless?
No, there's no wireless.
Kind of like good stuff, then.
No.
You had to get back with your information.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, it wasn't for information. It was in the sense of where the bomb struck, yeah.
Now, what about the mix of the bombs, and how many bombs would you add up?
Well, there were either... Let me see, there was 250 pound, there was a 500 pound, yeah. You carried either two 250s or one 500. There was three different bomb, there was two sets of bomb racks.
Mm-hmm.
One for the 250s out just beyond the fuselage, I think they were. And then they might have been together, I'm not sure, I forget now. And then I know that the 500 was carried right underneath.
And that'd be the only bombs you'd carry?
It'd be the only one, yeah.
Now, would these be incendiary or strictly...
On one point, there was a very dry spell come in, and there was an idea to set fire to the Black Forest.
Mm-hmm.
It was very dry, and we were loaded up with incendiary bombs, 20 small bombs. They were only... No, they're only about that long. And God knows how they were put in. I don't know. They were fastened to the machine some way. But we were all set to go. I think we were up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it came on to raid. That was the end of thermite bombs. That was the end of the... One of those thermite things would burn a hole through a railroad track, through a rail of a railroad.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Eh? Yeah. Just burning.
I think they, I have that in mind because I think there was a test made of the thing somewhere that the thermite was put onto this rail and just burned it right through like an ultra-acetylene torch.
What about the late action and things like that with the defusing of the bombs? Do you recall any of that?
Well, the they were armed. They were partly armed. They were put in the aircraft and partly armed. And then there was a spinner on the nose of the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And after you released it, see, they were half armed. And after you released it, the bomb fell nose down, the spinner started working, and finished the arming.
That'd be like almost like a propeller, I guess.
Yeah, it was a small propeller, yeah.
Just now, that was through the bomb. Now, would you have a toggle or a pull cord?
Yeah,
or
you had
the go?
Oh, no, I can't remember that, by golly.
Now, who would let them go? Would the observer or would the pilot?
No, the pilot let them go. It must have been a simply pull cord. There was a bomb sight. We all had a bomb sight on the side, I know, for drift and so on. It was mainly for drift.
Well, what were some of the procedures? You know, we're not talking any particular run now, but...
Well, you flew in formation to the designated to the target area.
Okay, and the target would be what, generally?
It would be one of the... Mannheim was the furthest I went. That was 104 miles over the line. And there were plenty of targets along the line, along the Rhine River, I should say, the industrial targets, you see.
So you'd be going after factories?
Yeah, that's right, the industrial targets, really.
So those civilian population nonsense of the Second War?
Went,
not going after civilian population like in the Second
War? No, that was incidental.
Incidental, unavoidable.
Yeah.
Now, what about... Yeah. What about the target itself? Now, were you given specific things to hit, or just to
general area? And I think that the leader's observer gave a hand signal, waved his hands or something like that to drop the bombs. I'm not sure, but I don't remember that part of it. But I know we did drop as the leader dropped. You see, there was a slight delay, of course.
And so you'd be going after like the leader, the squadron leader would virtually determine then the target.
That's right.
Now he, with two 250-pound bombs, would you make two passes or just let them both go at the same time? Or
they all went at the same time.
They all went at the same time.
Yeah.
Did it? You think of it at the time that 500 pounds of explosive. Was that all that much, or was it a great deal? How did you relate to a 500-pound bomb? I'm thinking in today's terms, I know it's difficult. It's hard for me to think of risking your life and going all that way to drop 500 pounds of bomb.
I don't think that I didn't have any thoughts about it at all. It was my job just to get over there, to fly formation, get over there, drop the bomb, get the hell home.
Now, the tough one, of course, is the radio communication still bothers me.
There was no radio communication at all.
Was there any ground signaling up to you?
No.
Nothing to speak of?
No, none at all.
You had a one-way blow tube. Or did you in the deal?
I don't think we did.
You didn't bother with one then,
I don't think so. The observer could lean over and could, mind you, there was a windscreen in front of the pilot. And I think he could talk to me. I don't know if I could talk to him or not. I could shake my head if I got the message or so on.
What about now? Would he have a Lewis on the back?
Yeah, there was a Lewis gun on the back, yeah.
No.
And he'd carry six or eight drums of ammunition.
So he'd have a Lewis on the back and you would have a mounted Vickers up front?
Yeah.
With the Conasco gear. Yeah. He'd be a fairly formidable target. I guess the only way they come at
you from below. There were lots of blind spots.
A lot of blind
spots. Yeah, there was blind spots underneath, you see. The observer had no chance at all. The gunner had no chance at all.
So would they be going for the gasoline or the fuel tanks for the pilot?
No, they'd simply be trying for the aircraft. They'd be aiming for the aircraft. That was the target.
Mm-mm. Now, the thing I guess I'm going to have to get to is parachutes.
No parachutes.
Any talk of a parachute during the time?
Yes, I think they had some chutes near the end of the war. But,
were they talked of in the mess? I was thinking more than anything else.
No, it wasn't mentioned. It was a no-no. Because I think everybody, there might have been the odd one who was had too much imagination, but I think most of us just didn't think about, we always thought we'd come back, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing is, too, was the feeling that one should stay with the plane, one was safer with the plane than jumping.
Well, that was my thought most of the time. I mean, if you're jumping, you were sure death. There was no doubt about it, because there was nothing to break the fall. It was absolutely certain. Even in later flying, when I was with the Air Force doing bush flying, really,
mm-hmm.
We had chutes. We didn't wear them. We just sat on them. But I knew that I was going to stay with the aircraft, and I could come down in trees and be reasonably safe. That is barring something. I knew how to land in trees, you see. And another thing, emergency rations and stuff was there. And it's easier to spot an aircraft than just a man walking in the bush, too.
Yeah. It sounds amazing you thought this out quite carefully.
Well, I did. There's a saying, there are bold pilots and there are old pilots, but there are no old bold pilots.
Well, I think we've got a pretty good stick for today. I think we've gone operational, and if we pick up next day if we can,
sure.
And pick up operational, I think we'll continue on. Thank you very much, Mr. Ullman.
Well, that's fine. I've got a lot of stuff on the on my after experience. I don't know if that is flying. I was flying steadily. I was in aviation steadily from 1928 until 1962. And I've got a lot of photographs of things that might be interesting to you, with some stories. Some stories and all. Here's a whole bag full of them.
Great. Well, you shut off the machine and all. We'll pick up next week with going operational 104 squadron and then continuing on with your career in the RCAF.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, sir.